Training. On my first day at the University of Kent's picturesque campus in the British seaside town of Chatham, I threw up in the bushes. Twice. I had convinced my editors at Runner's World to send me to Marcora's lab to learn more about his brain training theories, so that I could try them out myself while preparing for my first marathon. Shortly before my visit, Marcora's colleague Alexis Mauger had published a highly controversial study using a new effort-based protocol to measure VO2 max. Instead of putting subjects through a brainless test where the speed increases in set increments, Mauger's subjects ran or cycled at steadily increasing levels of self-determined effort. The results, which remain highly contentious, showed that subjects reached higher VO2 max values in the effort-based test than in the traditional test. An impossible paradox if you believe that VO2 max represents a physical ceiling on oxygen consumption. Mauger, a laid-back senior lecturer in jeans and flip-flops, offered to run me through the new test so I could compare it to my previous experiences with the standard test. He fitted a mask over my mouth and tied me into a safety harness dangling from the roof. "Just in case," he said, a little too cheerfully. "That last stage can be pretty tough." The biggest adjustment was that in order to maintain a relatively constant effort, 12 out of 20 for the first stage, for example, I had to start out quickly and then gradually reduce the pace during each 2-minute stage as my legs fatigued. For the last stage, which called for 2 minutes at an all-out effort of 20, I had to start out as if I were sprinting a 100-meter dash and then gradually decrease the treadmill speed just enough to avoid being thrown off the back as I tired. Balancing on the edge of that red line was quite literally gut-churningly hard. Fortunately, I made it back out to the parking lot before hurling. Mauger's study was co-published in the British Journal of Sports Medicine alongside another study from Noakes's group in Cape Town that also used a novel protocol to produce higher-than-max VO2 max values. That study, which was led by Noakes's student Fernando Beltrami, used a similar reverse protocol that started fast and gradually slowed down just enough to enable the subjects to stay on the treadmill as they tired. One of the curious details of Beltrami's study was that when the subjects returned to the lab for a follow-up test using the conventional accelerating VO2 max protocol, their values stayed at the new higher value. To Beltrami, who also coaches runners, this suggests that the mere fact of having attained a higher level of oxygen consumption somehow adjusts the brain's settings. He has since been experimenting with using the reverse VO2 max protocol as a training tool, for example, incorporating it into the preparations of an athlete training for a 100-kilometer race in Patagonia. This idea of adjusting the brain's settings evokes a long-standing debate. Who has to work harder, a 2-hour 30-minute marathoner or a 3-hour 30-minute marathoner? One standard, if deliberately provocative, answer is that the 3-hour 30-minute marathoner has a harder task because she has to spend an extra hour pushing her limits. But I've always thought that a better proxy for who works harder, on average, of course, is cumulative years and volume of training, not finishing time. The process of training expands the capabilities of the muscles and heart, sure, but it also recalibrates the brain's horizons. As we saw in Chapter 5, trained ultra-runners have a higher pain tolerance than non-athletes. And even over the course of a single year, the pain tolerance of athletes waxes and wanes with training cycles. In this sense, all training is brain training, even if it doesn't specifically target the brain. At the first beeping of my watch alarm, I spring out of bed, pull on my running shorts and trainers, slather on sunscreen, and sit down at my computer. At 7 a.m. on a Sunday in mid-May, several months after my visit to Kent, and just 2 weeks before the start of my first marathon, and time for my final big test. On the screen, an empty road disappears into a blue sky dotted with drifting clouds, rendered in simple 1980s video game graphics. With a sigh, I empty my mind and click a blue button marked Start, bracing myself for the drudgery ahead. Shapes begin flashing on the screen, sometimes to the left of the road and sometimes to the right. When it's a triangle, I hit a button corresponding to the side of the screen it's on as quickly as possible, usually within a few hundred milliseconds. When it's a circle, I do nothing. If I fail to respond within 2 seconds or respond when I shouldn't, the screen flashes red and the computer buzzes angrily. And that's it. For the next 60 minutes, my sole task is to keep my brain locked on this excruciatingly dull parade of shapes. They flash by rapidly, leaving no time to daydream, check the clock, or even glance out the window. Still, thoughts occasionally intrude. I find myself wondering how hot it is outside and whether I should have started earlier. Then, bam, the screen buzzes red. The longer I go, the more frequent my mistakes become. When the hour is finally up, I have that cotton-headed feeling of total mental exhaustion that's usually the cue to flop down in front of the TV for a few hours. Instead, I down a glass of water, step outside into the blinding sunshine, and start running. I lope through 2 miles, then gradually squeeze the pace down. I have a 15-mile progression run planned, with the last 6 at marathon race pace. My legs feel fine, but there's a persistent mismatch between the effort I'm feeling and the splits on my watch. The pace feels tougher than it should, and I have to concentrate to sustain it. Once again, I force my brain to zero in on a monotonous task, keeping my legs moving and hitting my goal splits, instead of watching shapes on a screen. As far as my brain is concerned, the effort feels more like the last 15 miles of a marathon than the first 15, which means the plan is working. While all training may be brain training, my visit to Marcora's lab introduced me to techniques that zero in on the specific aspects of brain function that limit endurance. As we saw in Chapter 4, he and others have identified a cognitive trait called response inhibition, which involves overriding your initial instinct as a key. A psychologist at the University of Portsmouth in Britain, Chris Wagstaff, offered a particularly graphic illustration of its importance for athletes. He asked cyclists to watch a 3-minute video showing an Asian woman causing herself to throw up and who subsequently eats her own vomit. Some of the volunteers were instructed to suppress any emotions and keep a poker face while watching, while others weren't given any instructions. In a subsequent 10-kilometer time trial, those who had kept a poker face cycled more slowly right from the start and experienced higher perceived effort. After 1 kilometer, the poker face group reported an average effort rating of almost 15 out of 20. Compared to 12 in the control group, despite going slower. That's a huge difference. How do you improve your response inhibition? By inhibiting your responses over and over in a systematic way. Marcora's mental fatigue studies use a set of standard cognitive tests that can be tailored to tax different aspects of cognitive control, including response inhibition. After my adventures with Mauger's VO2 max test, Marcora introduced me to Walter Steno, his postdoctoral research associate, who ushered me into a carpeted room with a big poster of Usain Bolt on the wall and an exercise bike surrounded by computer screens and jumbled cables and wires. After affixing electrodes to my bald pate to monitor my brain activity, he parked me on the bike and told me to follow the instructions on the screen while pedaling at a comfortable pace. My task? When 5 arrows flashed onto the pixelated road and sky backdrop of the screen, I was to ignore 4 of them and press a key indicating which direction the middle arrow was pointing. I did a double take as I read the instructions, "That's it?" I asked, recalling Marcora's warnings about how horrible these studies were. "That's it," Steno replied. "You can start whenever you're ready." The task was laughably easy at first, and as the seconds dragged by and arrows kept flashing, it didn't get any harder. But I soon developed a very strong desire to do something else, anything else. My mind wandered. I started thinking about the questions I wanted to ask Marcora, and whether I'd have time to go back to my hotel before lunch. Suddenly, a buzzer sounded and the screen flashed red. I'd pressed the wrong button. Chastened, I refocused on the screen. After a while, I figured I must have done enough of that particular task, so I suggested that we move on to the next one. I asked Steno how long I'd lasted. 5 minutes, Steno grinned. In the mental fatigue studies, they do 90 minutes. Suddenly, I understood why Marcora's subjects hated him. Funded by the British military's Center for Defense Enterprise, Marcora has spent the last few years experimenting with various brain endurance training protocols. 3 or 5 days a week, 30 to 60 minutes per session, sitting at a computer or riding on a stationary bike. In addition to the flashing arrows, he has also tried other cognitive tasks involving shapes and letters. So, to aid my preparations for that spring's Ottawa Marathon, he helped me devise a 12-week routine. 5 days a week, rotating through 3 different cognitive tasks, arrows, shapes, letters, starting with extremely modest sessions of 15 minutes, and progressing, if all went well, to 1.5 hours. By triggering the flood of neurotransmitters associated with mental fatigue, and in particular, response inhibition over and over, we hoped that my brain would adapt to the insult, and that my resistance to mental fatigue would translate into an ability to sustain a slightly faster pace at the same effort. I should pause here to acknowledge the obvious. I have no way of assessing whether the mental training actually helped my marathon. That's actually part of the reason I chose the marathon, a distance I had never run before, as a test, to avoid misleading comparisons with previous races. Rather than a study, I viewed my experiment as a chance to find out what brain endurance training felt like. Would it be tolerable, enjoyable, impossible? To that end, when I returned home and started training for the race, I tried to suppress my skepticism and follow the program. It wasn't easy. Initially, I rotated through the 3 different training tasks in 5-minute blocks, figuring variety would help stave off boredom. But when I emailed Marcora to double-check this approach, he had bad news. Being boring is an important characteristic for inducing mental fatigue, and therefore a brain training effect, he replied. Just do a longer session of 1 test at a time. After a few weeks, I'd progressed to 30-minute brain sessions. Sometimes, following Marcora's advice, I ran immediately after to practice running while mentally fatigued. The result was strikingly familiar. It felt like heading out for a run immediately after a stressful work or travel day, which is why one of Marcora's practical tips for incorporating brain training into your routine is to occasionally hit the gym after a long workday, rather than always training when you're mentally fresh. It wasn't so much that I couldn't run faster. It just felt harder than usual in a way that was difficult to pin down. I'd check my pace partway through a run, realize that I needed to speed up, but somehow be unable to summon the willpower to make it happen. 10 weeks before the race, I tested my fitness in a half marathon. I was satisfied with my time of 1 hour 15 minutes, but not with the distribution of my effort. My first and last 5K segments were the fastest, while the middle segments were the slowest. A failure of concentration reminiscent of my struggles with 5,000-meter races during my track running heyday. I scheduled my next test race 4 weeks later, and in the meantime I pushed my computer sessions to 60 and then 80 minutes. In that next half marathon, I managed just under 1 hour 13 minutes, and my splits revealed good news. I'd managed to keep pushing at a steady pace through the middle miles. And this time my last few miles were the slowest. In an odd way, this late race fade was exactly what I'd been striving for. Maybe, just maybe, the brain training was kicking in. On race day in Ottawa, I hit the halfway point in 1 hour, 18 minutes, 25 seconds, right on pace for my goal time of 2 hours, 37 minutes, a challenging but relatively sensible target given my half-marathon times. My breathing was smooth, my legs felt good, and my mind was acutely tuned to my pace. Of course, everyone feels that way halfway through a marathon. I knew the real test was still to come. I had planned some additional tricks to help manipulate my effort during the second half of the race. To harness the brain-fooling effects of carbohydrate in the mouth, I was swishing and spitting sports drink at every opportunity. And based on Marcora's research linking facial expression to perceived effort, I'd positioned friends and family at regular intervals along the course with instructions to make me smile. At one point, I rounded a corner and spotted my friend Shannon on the roadside, holding a giant yellow sign that read, "Remember when I brought you Burmese food and then ate it?" She'd once made an epic 10-hour drive back from Washington, D.C., where I had previously spent a few years working, with an order of my favorite dish from my favorite restaurant on ice as a surprise. And then, after a friend mistakenly told her that I was out of town, slurped down the last bite just as I returned her call. Her husband, Jeff, stood beside her, with an equally enormous sign that read simply, "She's sorry." I spat out a mouthful of Powerade in a graceful electric blue arc and broke into a grin. Soon I was steadily passing other runners. It's not that I sped up, everyone else was just slowing down. In fact, I was a metronome, nailing each split to within a few seconds with mental focus to spare. By the time I hit 30K, in 1 hour, 51 minutes, 35 seconds, still a few ticks under 2 hours, 37 minutes pace, I was riding the high of a plan that seemed to be coming together perfectly. There was just one discordant note. My quads were starting to feel sore. Most of my training had been on hilly dirt trails, and my legs weren't used to the repetitive pounding of flat asphalt roads. My wife, mother, and father had mapped out a series of cheering spots to sustain me during the crucial last 10K of the race. Each time I spotted one of them holding a sign or wearing a silly hat while screaming encouragement, I had more difficulty twisting my facial muscles in a smile. I thought back to what Marcora had told me about the difference between effort and pain. We often think of races as painful, but physical pain is completely distinct from the sense of effort, the struggle to keep going against a mounting desire to stop, that usually limits race speed. What I now felt in my quads was pain resulting from physical damage to the muscle fibers in my legs, an electric, stabbing sensation that my hours of clicking at the computer had done nothing to prepare me for. And it was rapidly approaching intolerable. I clicked a button on my watch as I passed the 35K mark. I was still on 2 hours, 38 minutes pace, but the wheels were about to come off. Over the last 4 miles, I had the surreal sensation that the race was running backward as people I had passed during the middle miles started to pass me back. Even stranger, as the pain in my quads intensified, my overall sense of effort decreased. My breathing and heart rate slowed because my legs simply could no longer move fast enough to keep them elevated. I was reduced to a jog, frustrated but powerless to accelerate. I stopped checking splits and recalculating my finish time because it was going to take all my mental strength to make it to the finish without walking. After the race, I had the awkward task of writing a magazine article about my experience. After hobbling across the finish line in an undeniably disappointing 2 hours, 44 minutes, 48 seconds, what could I possibly say about whether brain endurance training really worked? When I contacted Marcora for a post-race debrief, what I most wanted to know was whether I could really blame my late race fade on pain rather than on a failure of brain endurance. "Of course," he said. "You had muscle pain, which was so intense as to limit your performance." I could no more run through the damaged muscle fibers in my legs than I could run through a broken ankle, he explained. In most cases, exercise only generates moderate levels of muscle pain and is limited by extreme levels of effort. But sometimes, as I discovered, it's the other way around. In the end, I did gain some insights from the experience. For one thing, brain endurance training is mind-numbingly boring. For another, it's incredibly time-consuming. For anyone whose athletic pursuits have to fit around family and job obligations, making time for marathon training is already tough enough. Adding in another hour or more a day is a big ask, especially when the benefits remain unproven. That's why Marcora's most recent studies have used a combined protocol where subjects do physical and mental training at the same time. In 2015, Staino and Marcora presented recently declassified results from a military-funded study of 35 volunteers who had trained three times a week for an hour at a time on stationary bikes. Half of the volunteers did brain training while cycling, using the flashing letters test that I had tried. After 12 weeks, the physical training-only group had improved their time to exhaustion by 42%. In comparison, the physical plus brain training group had improved by a whopping 126%. This hybrid protocol is more time efficient and less boring than the brain training only protocol I followed. And with effects that large, I suspect lots of people would be willing to endure a little boredom. That's not to say brain endurance training is ready for prime time. The whole field of brain training, particularly as a tool to ward off cognitive decline, has been mired in controversy in recent years. It's now a billion-dollar industry, but a 2016 analysis of virtually every brain training study ever published concluded that there is little evidence for transferability, that is, training yourself to click buttons in response to flashing letters or shapes doesn't necessarily translate into, say, remembering phone numbers or acing exams. Can it transfer to running a faster marathon? We should reserve judgment until those experiments have been completed and then confirmed by multiple researchers from different laboratories. There's another important caveat, which is that Marcora's most impressive results are seen in previously untrained volunteers, a group that is primed to improve under almost any circumstances. But is the same true for athletes who are already engaged in the mentally demanding task of physical endurance training? Perhaps hours of focus during long bike rides or demanding trail runs hone your mental fitness to the point of diminishing returns. That's a possibility Marcora is well aware of, and he is currently planning brain training studies with elite athletes. And it's why he collaborated with researchers at the Australian Institute of Sport on the study of elite cyclists described earlier. Because one way to figure out how to make our brains better is to look at the brains of people who are already elite performers. Entering the final length in the 200-meter freestyle final at the 2008 Beijing Olympics, swimmer Sarah Isakovich tucked into her flip turn, uncoiled her legs, and felt nothing. Instead of exploding off the wall, the 20-year-old Slovenian felt her toes just barely graze it. "I remember thinking, this is not happening. Why now?" recalls Isakovich. "Then in a split second, I was able to refocus." Riding a surge of adrenaline, she tore down the last length to nab a silver medal, breaking the previous world record and missing gold by just 0.15 seconds. Olympic athletes are strong and fit and tough, but none of that matters if they're not also resilient, capable of shaking off setbacks and adapting quickly to unexpected circumstances. When I met Isakovich in 2013, she was a research assistant at the University of California, San Diego, working with a neuroscientist and psychiatrist named Martin Paulus to identify the neural characteristics that separate elite endurance performers from the rest of us, the mental skills that allowed her to regroup instead of crumble in Beijing. We usually think along the lines of how you make someone less bad, Paulus explained to me. Instead, we're asking whether we can use neuroscience and brain imaging in particular to understand how to make the brain work better. Paulus came to UCSD from Germany in 1986, and he rapidly adjusted to the California lifestyle, though he recently accepted a cross appointment at the Laureate Institute for Brain Research in Oklahoma. He's an avid cyclist with the notably calm demeanor of someone who has been practicing Zen meditation for 3 decades. "I get up at 5," he says, "and I hit the cushion by 5:10. A major strand of his research is focused on the role of interoception, the brain's monitoring of internal signals in the body, like temperature, hunger, blood oxygen levels, and so on, in anxiety disorders and addiction. Anxious people, he found, tend to overreact to negative stimuli, producing a distinct pattern of brain activity. Elite endurance athletes, on the other hand, display a completely opposite response pattern. Was there a way, he wondered, of training the brains of the former to look more like the latter? On a bright fall day, Zakovich led me across the UCSD campus from Paulus's lab to a building where the group's research volunteers come for brain imaging. The protocol involves climbing into the cylindrical bore of a giant 3-Tesla magnet for functional MRI scanning, which detects subtle changes in oxygen use to identify which areas of the brain are tackling different tasks. While they're in the claustrophobia-inducing confines of the fMRI, the subjects complete some simple cognitive tests similar to the ones Marcora uses, all the while breathing through a special tube. The twist? Periodically, and without warning, the flow of oxygen through the tube is restricted temporarily, making it difficult but not impossible to breathe. The volunteer on the day I visited was taking part in a study of teen drug users, which was looking for telltale patterns in their response to this stressful, aversive stimulus. Paulus and his colleagues have found that crucial differences show up in the activation of the insular cortex, a region of the brain that monitors sensory signals from within the body. In a series of studies starting in 2012, the researchers put hardened Marines, elite adventure racers, and ordinary people through the fMRI tests. Some members of the control groups panicked and had to be removed from the scanner. But the elite performers handled the scenario with ease. In fact, while the control groups got worse at the cognitive task when their breathing was restricted, the elite groups actually got better. Precisely the sort of performance under stress that enables you to dig a little deeper when the stakes are highest, whether in the heat of combat or at the end of a multi-day adventure race. Before the breathing restriction starts, the athletes already have higher levels of activity in their insular cortex, consistent with the idea that they've become adept at monitoring their own signals. Typically, athletes are pretty in tune with their body awareness, Lori Haas, another of Paulus's colleagues, told me. They're in a state of watchful anticipation, ready to handle any discomfort that arises. Then, when the flow of air is restricted and the discomfort begins, the situation flips. Insular cortex activity stays low in the athletes, but goes haywire in the controls and in people with anxiety and related problems. Paulus draws a direct link between these findings and the research of Noakes and others on the importance of perceived effort in endurance. First, heightened internal awareness allows elite endurance athletes to anticipate and prepare for unpleasantness, avoiding the all-important mismatch between expected and actual effort described by Tucker. Then subduing the natural reaction or overreaction to discomfort, what Marcora calls response inhibition, allows them to push on. So, how do you train your insular cortex? The approach that Paulus came up with reflects his Buddhist leanings. After all, the internal awareness that characterizes elite endurance athletes sounds a lot like the Buddhist concept of mindfulness, which in recent years has emerged as a mainstream fad with best-selling apps and wide-ranging claims about its curative powers for everything from depression to the common cold. The extraction of mindfulness from its Buddhist context began in the 1970s when a University of Massachusetts researcher and Zen student named Jon Kabat-Zinn began developing what became a standardized 8-week mindfulness-based stress reduction course. The goal, Paulus explains, is to cultivate non-judgmental self-awareness. For a marathoner, leg pain and shortness of breath become neutral sources of information to be used for pacing rather than emotionally charged warnings to panic about. You learn to monitor how your body actually feels while suspending judgment about it, he says. As with Marcora's brain training ideas, the first interest in Paulus's plans came from the military. His location in San Diego gives him easy access to collaborators at the Naval Health Research Center, as well as to Marines training at nearby Camp Pendleton, and Special Forces troops, including Navy SEALs, across San Diego Bay at Naval Amphibious Base Coronado. In one study published in 2016, a group led by Paulus and Haas's colleague Douglas Johnson of UCSD and the Naval Health Research Center's Warfighter Performance Department followed 8 Marine infantry platoons during training prior to deployment to Afghanistan. Half the platoons received a specially modified version of Kabat-Zinn's 8-week mindfulness training to see if the brain patterns of the raw recruits could be altered to make them more like the hardened Navy SEALs and elite endurance athletes the researchers had previously tested. Sure enough, while brain scans in the training-as-usual platoons showed the usual panicked leap in insular cortex activity when breathing restriction kicked in, the mindfulness-trained Marines instead reduced their insular cortex activity. The hope, though this remains to be tested, is that this heightened resilience to stress will help the soldiers handle the inevitable chaos they will encounter during combat and reduce their likelihood of developing post-traumatic stress disorder. The demands facing athletes are, of course, different from those encountered by soldiers. So Haas and Paulus, working with collaborators from the UCSD Center for Mindfulness, decided to develop a program tailored specifically for sports performance. The result was MPEAK, Mindful Performance Enhancement, Awareness and Knowledge, another 8-week program modeled on Kabat-Zinn's stress reduction course. This version of mindfulness training puts more emphasis on sport-specific skills, like concentration and embracing rather than avoiding pain, and addresses common athlete pitfalls, like perfectionism, by teaching self-compassion. It also incorporates what Haas calls experiential exercises, like breathing through a straw or holding your hand in a bucket of ice water for as long as you can. To test the protocol, Haas teamed up with 7 athletes from the U.S. Olympic BMX racing team, whose athletes compete in a series of intense, rough-and-tumble bike races over challenging courses with no margin for error. Once again, brain scans showed a shift to more optimal responses to stressful challenges like breath restriction, and the teaching sessions offered the athletes a chance to reflect on what goes on in their mind in these moments of stress. The superficial thoughts are obvious. It's typically like, I can't breathe, I need more air. If I don't get more air, I'm going to pass out, Haas says. But there's also an underlying narrative that determines how you react to those sensations, which can be either positive or negative. Subjectively, psychological tests show that the BMX riders displayed greater awareness of bodily sensations, and the national team head coach noted improvements in their race performance. Their body language is calmer in the gate, the coach said. They move their hands less on the bars, and they get out of the gate a little faster. For now, it's hard to classify either Marcora's or Haas and Paulus's brain training approaches as anything more than intriguing anecdotes. They're both based on well-researched concepts, but the road from theory to practice is littered with the smoking remains of countless heavily hyped ideas that didn't pan out. So we'll have to wait. In the meantime, Marcora is working with an app developer to make his brain endurance training protocol portable and easy to use. And Haas and her colleagues have run more tests on a high school lacrosse team and submitted a proposal to deploy MPEAK for perhaps the greatest endurance challenge of all, testing potential Mars astronauts for NASA. It's an alluring thought that the right stuff isn't, after all, something you have to be born with. Perhaps with sufficient hard work and mental effort, you can train it. Or maybe there's a shortcut. Chapter 12. Zapping the Brain. A sharp bang, like the crack of a rifle, echoed off the walls of the converted warehouse. After a brief, shocked silence, everyone rushed to their bikes, checking to see whose tire had blown. Personally, I was more worried about the guy slumped in a dentist's chair at the far end of the room, dripping sweat and dangling wires, who was getting zapped by a brain stimulator that looked like a ping-pong paddle with two heads. I stowed the notebook where I'd been scribbling notes and headed over to find out. If we had just blown out Tim Johnson's brain, I didn't want to write about it. I was at Red Bull's global headquarters, located in a low-slung industrial neighborhood in Santa Monica, California, for a boundary-pushing training camp-slash-science experiment that the company dubbed Project Endurance. Five world-class cyclists and triathletes had flown in, voluntarily, as far as I knew, to be prodded, zapped, and repeatedly pushed to their limits by a multinational swarm of several dozen researchers who would measure their every twitch and palpitation. The big question they were hunting: what role does the brain play in setting our physical limits? And can we change those limits, break through to another level, by trickling a small electric current through the brain's motor cortex? To find out, the energy drink company enlisted Dylan Edwards and David Petrino, a pair of Australian-born neuroscientists at the Burke Rehabilitation Center and Weill Cornell Medical College in New York, to devise a 5-day testing protocol. 3 days at Red Bull headquarters in Santa Monica, 2 at the StubHub Velodrome 20 miles down the 405 in Carson, using electric and magnetic brain stimulation, peripheral nerve stimulation, EMG, EEG, and an array of other measurement tools to tease apart the effects of central, in the brain, and peripheral, in the muscles, fatigue, as the athletes were pushed to the breaking point again and again. I think of my brain as a tool, Johnson, a 6-time national cyclocross champion, had been explaining to me a few minutes before the bang. Racing, he said, was as much a battle against the limits imposed by his mind as it was a contest with his competitors. Fortunately, the loud explosion hadn't inflicted any damage on his tool. If anything, it was the other way around. Johnson's brain had somehow blown a circuit in one of the brain stimulation machines. Testing halted for a few hours while a replacement machine was rushed into place, and I seized the opportunity to quiz Holden McRae, a sports medicine professor at Pepperdine University, who also serves as Red Bull's chief physiologist, about the project's ultimate goals. "It's about the nature of fatigue," explained McRae, a trim, straight-backed South African expat. "Why do we slow down? Why do we make that decision to slow down?" McRae had worked with, guess who, Tim Noakes, during his PhD work in Cape Town in the late 1980s, studying the effects of endurance training on lactate production, and was heavily influenced by Noakes's ideas about the brain's role in exercise. But for Red Bull's quest to push limits and give its athletes an edge, the mere existence of the central governor theory wasn't the point, and nor was the sometimes esoteric debate between Noakes and Marcora. "We know there's something in the brain that regulates performance," McRae said matter-of-factly. Now we want to see if we can manipulate it. People have been shocking their brains for fun and profit since long before anyone understood what electricity was. Scribonius Largus, the court physician for the Roman Emperor Claudius, more than 2,000 years ago, recommended the application of a live torpedo fish, an electric ray capable of delivering up to 200 volts at a time, to the forehead for relief of headaches, and other cultures around the world prescribed electric fish for everything from epilepsy to exorcism. By the end of the 18th century, the great debate between Luigi Galvani and Alessandro Volta had introduced the idea of animal electricity to the world. Galvani's nephew, Giovanni Aldini, soon began using galvanism to treat depression in Bologna, as well as applying electricity to the brains of freshly decapitated criminals to elicit bizarre facial expressions. In the two centuries since then, various forms of electrical brain stimulation for mental health and other conditions have drifted in and out of fashion with decidedly mixed results. These days, talk of electricity in the brain still tends to provoke comments about either Frankenstein, a book that was reputedly inspired in part by Aldini's public demonstrations, or One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. My first thought was, how is this different from the electroshock therapy they did in the 1950s, admitted Rebecca Rush, an ultra-distance mountain biker who was the first Red Bull athlete in the dentist's chair that morning. I was like, they're going to do what to my head? But the technique Edwards and Putrino had in mind, known as transcranial direct current stimulation, or TDCS, is very different. So Rush had eventually come around to the idea, lured by the promise of learning more about the hidden reserves she relies on to win races. If you're being chased by a lion, or a car falls on a baby, you find something extra, she said. I think we're just touching the iceberg of how do we train that. From a functional perspective, the brain is basically a giant electric circuit, a vast web of interconnected neurons that communicate with each other by firing electric discharges. The relatively strong currents applied in electroshock, or as it's now known, electroconvulsive therapy, trigger all the affected neurons to fire at once, causing a seizure. In TDCS, the current is 500 to 1,000 times smaller, too small to directly cause the neurons to fire. Instead, sustaining this small trickle of current for 10 to 20 minutes alters the sensitivity of the neurons, making them slightly more likely to fire, or, if you run the current in the opposite direction, slightly less likely to fire. The current on its own does nothing, but it primes your brain to respond differently to whatever happens next. The technique is disarmingly, almost disturbingly, simple to administer. You connect a voltage source, a 9-volt battery will do, to two electrodes placed on opposite sides of your head. The precise placement of the electrodes determines which regions of your brain the current flows through. And there's no question that TDCS can have real effects. Between 2013 and 2016 alone, researchers published more than 2,000 studies exploring the technique's potential for goals as varied as enhancing learning, fighting addiction and depression, and improving walking ability in patients with neurological diseases. One report describes significant improvement in trunk peak velocity during tango dancing in a 79-year-old Argentinian man with moderate Parkinson's. In another report, soldiers improved their ability to spot snipers in a virtual reality simulation. There's also no question, though, that TDCS hype has long since diverged from what researchers, or the vibrant DIY TDCS community, have actually demonstrated, triggering a skeptical backlash. At a conference in 2016, Jurgi Bashaki of New York University presented results from a cadaver study showing that only about 10% of the electric current that is applied to a skull even makes it into the brain, prompting one TDCS researcher to describe the field as a sea of bullshit and bad science. So as I watched the proceedings at Red Bull, I filtered my impressions through a veil of skepticism. Yes, it seemed reasonable that electricity could alter brain function, but to enhance endurance, you would need to know exactly which part of the brain sets your limits. A few weeks after the London Olympics in 2012, I was in Zurich to cover the Weltklasse track meet, the traditional season-ending supermeet that has hosted more than 24 world records over the years. But I skipped the morning media events with Usain Bolt and other stars, opting instead to hop onto a tram that took me to a satellite campus of the University of Zurich in a northern suburb of the city. I had arranged to meet a neuropsychologist named Kai Lutz, who was pioneering a new approach to the study of endurance. For years, researchers like Noakes had speculated about what might be happening in the brain at the moment of exhaustion. Lutz, who had spent 15 years acquiring expertise in advanced neuroimaging, had a seemingly radical notion. Why not take a look inside to find out? To be fair, looking inside the brain during exercise is a daunting technical challenge, and even now, it can only be done under very specific and, critics would say, unnatural conditions. The bike in an MRI machine that Noakes showed me, which involved lying on your back in a magnet bore while pedaling a drive shaft, hasn't yet yielded any significant insights. Lutz, whose interest in the limits of endurance was initially spurred by his brain imaging studies on the mysteries of tooth pain, took a more cautious and methodical approach. A soft-spoken and meticulous German researcher who had moved to Switzerland after completing his PhD, he started with a relatively simple experiment, in which volunteers were tested on hand grip strength. They repeated a series of 13-second contractions, with the required strength carefully manipulated so that they would fail to hold it about half the time. Functional MRI scans showed that two regions of the brain, the insular cortex and the thalamus, were more active during the failed contractions. The results made sense, since, as Martin Paulus's resilience studies described in the previous chapter also found, the insular cortex monitors incoming signals from the rest of the body. It's not just muscle signals, Lutz notes. The insular cortex is also involved in the emotional response of hearing your heart pound and so on. MRI scans are great for pinpointing what regions of the brain are involved in a given activity, but they're less useful for figuring out what each region is actually doing. The main problem is that they're slow. To get decent resolution, you need 2 or 3 seconds per scan, and they're also indirect measures of brain activity. They measure the changes in blood flow in different regions of the brain, which happen after you use that part of the brain. In contrast, you can use electroencephalography, better known as EEG, to listen directly to the electrical activity in the brain in real time, although the data is messier and harder to interpret. The first study used MRI to figure out where to look, Lutz explained, and that enabled them to zero in for a more detailed investigation with EEG. In the EEG study, volunteers strapped on what looked like a shower cap dotted with 128 silver electrodes to measure their brain activity, then rode a stationary bike for 30 to 40 minutes until they reached exhaustion. They had to keep their heads as still as possible, staring straight ahead at a sheet of paper with a cross on it to avoid making eye movements that would throw the EEG measurements off. With the heightened time sensitivity of the EEG data, a telltale pattern emerged in the data. Shortly before the cyclists gave up, there was an increase in communication between the insular cortex, which was monitoring their internal condition, and the motor cortex, which issued the final commands to their leg muscles. The brain, in other words, knew that the cyclists were about to reach their limits before their legs actually failed, seemingly demonstrating Noakes's anticipatory regulation in action. Lutz's doctoral student, who was running the study, sent an email to Noakes saying, in essence, "Look, we've found the central governor." For anyone interested in the athletic potential of brain stimulation, Lutz's results, which were published in late 2011, painted a bright target on two areas in the brain, the insular cortex and the motor cortex. Suppress the excitability of neurons in the insular cortex, the site of Lutz's central governor, and you might turn down the insular cortex's brake signal, allowing the motor cortex to keep driving the muscles for a little longer. Or alternately, enhance motor cortex excitability, and you might enable those neurons to simply ignore the brake signal and keep firing. The latter approach, stimulating the motor cortex, had already been explored in a relatively obscure study published 4 years earlier by Alberto Priori, an Italian researcher at the University of Milan who was one of the pioneers of TDCS. He found that a 10-minute bout of TDCS to the motor cortex boosted endurance by about 15% in a sustained contraction of the elbow flexors, the muscles you use in a biceps curl, compared to when the volunteers received sham stimulation. Support, seemingly, for the idea that brain stimulation can amplify the output from the motor cortex in the face of fatigue. And it didn't take long following the publication of Lutz's results for researchers to try stimulating the insular cortex. In 2015, a Brazilian group led by Alexandre Ocano of the Federal University of Rio Grande do Norte published the results of a brain stimulation test on 10 national class cyclists. This time, the cyclists received 20 minutes of TDCS to the temporal and insular cortices, an inevitable consequence of brain structure since current has to flow through the temporal cortex to reach the insular cortex underneath it. In a progressively accelerating ride to exhaustion, the cyclists increased their peak power by about 4% when they received real TDCS compared to the sham stimulation used as a placebo. Strikingly, their rating of perceived effort was lower right from the beginning of the cycling test, a finding consistent with the idea that the insular cortex monitors signals from throughout the body and assesses their significance. It's tempting to see these results as puzzle pieces that fit neatly into a coherent picture of how the brain controls endurance. After all, the fact that the insular cortex keeps turning up in these studies is awfully suggestive. But the full story is likely more complicated. For example, Ocano's subjects also showed changes in heart rate, suggesting that stimulation had altered the function of the central nervous system. TDCS is, after all, a blunt tool. It's impossible to limit stimulation to a single brain area, since the current has to flow from one electrode to the other through multiple brain regions. When I asked Priori how he interpreted his own results, he too was reluctant to paint a simple picture of TDCS either suppressing input to the brain or enhancing output. It's likely a mix of both, he said. So let's hold off for now on drawing any conclusions on exactly how a putative central governor might work. These initial results suggest some promising avenues for researchers to pursue as brain imaging and stimulation technology improves. Further studies, meanwhile, have implicated other brain areas in the regulation of endurance, including the prefrontal cortex, which seems to get starved of oxygen as physical exhaustion approaches, and the anterior cingulate cortex, which is closely tied to the perception of effort. To Kai Lutz, whose EEG research pointed a finger at the insular cortex, all these possibilities are not mutually exclusive. Instead, he sees motivation, effort, and pain as distinct but interrelated factors that influence endurance through separate processing loops between various brain regions. The firmest conclusions from Priori's and Ocano's studies, in the end, is something simpler but no less powerful. a proof of principle that when it comes to manipulating the brain to enhance endurance, something somehow seems to work. And that, not surprisingly, was enough to get the attention of the sports world. There's at least 17 devices stuck to my body right now, if I'm counting correctly, said Jesse Thomas, an ultra-distance triathlete who had flown in from his home in Oregon for the Red Bull Project. And that doesn't even count the brain stuff. There's another 30 wires there. Thomas was surrounded by a swarm of scientists and technicians who were wiring him up for another series of maximal exercise tests, which would culminate with a 4-kilometer all-out time trial on the stationary bike. In addition to the brain stimulation, Red Bull's scientific team was measuring a bewildering array of variables, from blood and urine samples to brain waves to leg angles to oxygen saturation in his muscle cells. If you take a step back and imagine yourself floating above and looking down on all this, it's actually pretty funny, Thomas acknowledged. How did we get to this point? Red Bull's ethos of extreme adventure and boundary pushing applies as much to its high-performance research program as it does to its athletes and advertising, all of which are, of course, intertwined. Felix Baumgartner's record-breaking skydive from the stratosphere, in which he reached a supersonic speed of 833.9 miles per hour, was a perfect illustration of how the company likes to mix stunt and science. They've also made a habit of bringing together top athletes from various sports and pushing them in novel ways, sending surfers, skiers, and snowboarders to Hawaii to learn freediving and breath-holding skills, for example. Similarly, the brain stimulation camp was as much about convincing the athletes that they were capable of more than they realized as it was about the science. Still, Edwards and Petrino, the Australian neuroscientists, were determined to seize the opportunity to collect some unique data, and in doing so, to highlight the link between athletic training and physical rehabilitation from conditions like brain and spinal cord injuries, which is their primary research interest. Rehab and high-intensity training are not as different as people believe, Petrino said. Whether you're a high-end athlete or a patient fighting locked-in syndrome, you're dealing with the same limitations of muscle fatigue. Research into the use of TDCS to help paralyzed patients in the long and arduous process of relearning to walk had been spurred in part by Priory's 2007 study of motor cortex stimulation. So Edwards and Petrino elected to try a similar protocol on the athletes. Our brains are sending signals to our muscles. As we fatigue, those signals are getting weaker and weaker, Petrino explained. The brain is making a choice, but the brain's opinion isn't always right. One of the key elements of the experiment was that the athletes would only get real brain stimulation half the time. They would go through all the motions before each of the 6 all-out 4-kilometer time trials that they completed over 4 days, first in the controlled lab environment at Red Bull headquarters and then at the velodrome. But half the time, the current would be turned off after a minute. To demonstrate, Edwards wired me up in a neoprene cap embedded with 8 electrodes, then ramped up the current. I briefly felt the faint sensation of thousands of very small ants crawling on my scalp, but it quickly faded, and I soon couldn't tell whether the current was on or off. In fact, even after I'd taken the cap off, I kept imagining I still felt the ants. So for any given time trial, the athletes had no way of knowing whether their brains were juiced or not. Only the stopwatch would, in theory, tell. In March 2016, James Michael McAdoo, a power forward for the Golden State Warriors, tweeted out a photo of himself in the training room, sporting a pair of slick over-the-ear headphones. Though you couldn't tell from the picture, these particular headphones incorporated a miniature fakir's bed of soft plastic spikes above each ear, pressing gently into the skull and delivering pulses of electric current to the brain. Made by a Silicon Valley startup called Halo Neuroscience, The headphones promised to accelerate gains in strength, explosiveness, and dexterity through a proprietary technique called neuropriming.